an interview at the New York State Military Museum, Saratoga Springs, New York. It is the 4th of January, 2005, approximately 1 p.m. Interviewers are Wayne Clark and Mike Russert. Could you give me your full name, date of birth, and place of birth, please?
Yeah, Robert A. Addison. I was born in Akron, Ohio on December 7th, 1922.
Okay. what was your educational background prior to entering service?
Well, I'd graduated from high school preceding January of 41, and I had started at Mount Union College, which was in my hometown of Alliance, Ohio. And in November, I got appendicitis, and back in those days, they keep you in the hospital for a couple of weeks, and then ups, and then as I was recuperating, on my birthday, December 7th, 1941, some of the fellows were in, and we were, you know, just batting the breeze, and my younger sister came home from the movie and said they stopped the movie and announced that they bombed Pearl Harbor. And so that's where I was in the process of in college. And so,
do you remember your reaction and the reaction of those that were with you when they heard that?
Oh yeah, everybody was pretty shocked, you know. And of course, I didn't realize it till I was down downtown, you know, in a malt shop, you know. I said, "Oh, son of a gun, that was my birthday," you know. So I had a personal vendetta against them, I guess. And
was the whole town buzzing about it?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, different reactions. Some of the fellas, "Oh, this is going to take 6 weeks, you know. They got little 22 rifles." Well, they had 25s, but 25s are a lot more powerful than 22s, we found out. And but us, the fellas, and then so I said, well, I played football, basketball, baseball all the way through school. And so football out there is big stuff. I don't know if you're... It's where Paul Brown got his start in Massillon. I played against these high school teams, and I'd like to be part of the best or something. And so, well, I heard the Marine Corps, pretty good guys, so I went down and asked them. I said, "How long after appendicitis will you take me?" And he says, "Well, how long has it been?" I said, "Well, 6 weeks, anytime." Ooh, yeah. So I went home, and my mother says, "What do you say, take any time?" "No, like hell, you know, you're going to wait till after the holidays." So January 7th, then I went down and I left for the Marine Corps on January 7th.
So you picked the Marines because you felt that they were the best organization? Where did you go for your training?
Well, we went to Paris Island. Now, of course, all the Marine, I guess they had just a skeleton, skeleton of two divisions, very, very basic. And so they were bringing them in 500 a day down at Paris Island, and they had cut boot camp from 13 weeks to 6 weeks. So what they usually did would have 2 weeks of close order drill, and then they'd send you to rifle range for 3 weeks, and back for close, you know, a week of extended order drill, and you were through. Well, when it came time for us to go to the rifle range, was a room, because we're, you know, coming in 500 a day. So they put 500 on a train and shipped us up to Quantico. Now, this is the latter part of January, the first part of February. I don't know, Quantico is in Virginia, but it still gets cold and rainy, and it was miserable on that rifle range. In fact, I think it was the only time during record day that the Marine Corps called off record because the targets were flying out of the racks. They were so windy. And anyway, and
how was the training? Was it pretty tough, that 6 weeks?
Well, a lot of the guys we had a lot of guys from New York City, and it was very rough on them, but I found it wasn't as tough as high school football in Ohio. So it didn't
now,
have any problem.
Now, what kind of guns were you using at the time? The O-3s?
We had the O-3s, and we took the O-3s all the way through Guadalcanal.
You did?
Yeah.
Now, when you were first went to basic training, did you have the old World War One helmets and so on?
No, we just had those old pith helmets, you know, at the time. And I never got one of those. They were in the process of changing over. And so, and now the Raiders were forming in Quantico at the time. They were the old 1st Battalion of the 5th Marines. And they'd been pulling maneuvers up and down the East Coast, and they were stationed there. And so they pulled them out of the 5th Regiment, and were going to make it what they call the 1st Separate Battalion. But then they decided to go with the name Raiders.
Now, did you have to volunteer for this, or were you picked?
Yes, this was another volunteer.
Volunteer?
They came out, we were just about to finish boot camp, and they came out, so we got this outfit, told us what kind of an outfit it was, and they took us into a barracks and interviewed us, and then they picked the ones, and then so here was a crop of fresh guys. So that's how they built up the battalion, from these guys just finishing boot camp right there in Quantico.
How many guys volunteered out of your group?
I don't know. I don't recall.
Was there quite a few?
Quite a few, yeah. There were quite a few. See, we had, 60-some in the platoon. And I would judge 30, 40 of us volunteered. And they took most of us. Some of them they didn't. I don't know why. They picked me, though. I got a feeling one of the reasons they picked me is because of my high school football, you know. They knew football back in there. And the fellow that interviewed me was Major Captain Bailey at the time, and he'd been a pro football player, and then he was picked. And one fellow in my boot camp platoon, they didn't pick. I don't know why, but this fellow just wasn't the type they wanted. And the battalion still wasn't built up, and that was my graduation from boot camp, marching from the rifle range into A barracks in Quantico, and that was it. So then we became right into the Edson's Raider, it was called just the 1st Marine Raider Battalion at that time. And that was about the middle of 17th, 18th of February. And then we went into real stiff training then.
Where did you go? Did you stay there?
Right there in Quantico. And where we pulled maneuvers and everything's all built up now, you know. And I don't think they have infantry type people there at this point. And so they kept doing it. And then in April, we had an oversized battalion. Most of the battalions were about 750 men. And they had 3 rifle companies, a weapons company, and a headquarters company. Well, we had 4 rifle companies, so we were close to 900 men. And one rifle company, D Company, was not fully developed yet. And in the meantime, I was put into 81-millimeter mortars. But then they decided, no, we're going to do away with those. Those are too big to carry. You know, the base plate weighs about 80 pounds. And a good thing it did, because we could never have gotten it through some of the places we had to go through. And so then we were there. And in April, the company's headquarters, most of the headquarters company in A, B, C, and E Company, which is what I had been in with the mortars, they chugged off for San Diego and eventually went to Samoa for 2 months. And we were back in Quantico waiting for this other rifle company to fully develop. So they didn't know what to do with us, you know. So they sent them to demolition school. So we took a 6-week course in 10 days, you know, and So I went overseas, and in June, we went over, I went overseas as a demolition person. We stopped at Samoa, picked up our battalion, went on to New Caledonia. Well, we got there, they already had most of their demolition people they needed, so they threw me back into E Company in 60-millimeter mortars. So that's the way I went into, finished up, I was 60-millimeter mortars all the way through. And then we finally got word, and now we traveled on APDs. I don't know if you know, those were the old World War I 4-stack destroyers. And they had put new diesel motors in them, and there was room for a company of troops in these APDs. And that's what they had pulled maneuvers on prior to the war up and down the coast. So they were attached to our battalion. We didn't go overseas in those. We went overseas in a big transport. We got to New Caledonia. There were 4 of them were there. And we pulled some more maneuvers there. And then shoved off, went up to the Fijis. Well, here I am one day up on a ridge. There they go again. I'm left behind again. But they just didn't have room in those 4 destroyers for all of us. And so there was a... there was a New Zealand, and it had been somewhat of a luxury liner, you know, one of these liners where they had dance halls and all that, but they had put a few 6-inch guns on it and called it a cruiser. from Manawai was his name. And they went down. He had just brought a load of mutton from New Zealand up to New Caledonia. So they went down and approached him. Yeah, I'll take you up, sure. So the rest of us filed aboard there and went up to the Fijis. And he wanted to go all the way. No, you go home back. So they put us on transports who were filled up all the time. So at the time, they were complete. So we would just sleep up on deck. And we pulled a few maneuvers there. Then, August 7th, we hit the island of Tulagi. And I think the reason they chose us to do that because our fellows were in pretty good shape because they'd been in Samoa a couple of months. The rest of the division had just gone to Australia. And they were in any kind of shape. But the reason we had to go in the Guadalcanal was they found out that they were building this airstrip on Guadalcanal. Uh-huh. And, you know, and prior to that, the Japs had lost 4 aircraft carriers to Battle of Midway. So they had to get other means, in other words, to you know, so they could bomb or, you know, take off a place where they could base planes to go to Australia, New Zealand, New Caledonia, Samoa, whatever. And so they were building this airstrip, and so we had to get it back. And so on the 7th of August, we 8 o'clock, as this thing here says, we were the first offensive ground troops to engage.
Why don't you hold that up in front of you, Wayne, to focus on that?
Yeah, we were the first offensive ground troops to engage the Japanese because we went in Tulagi at 8 o'clock. The rest of the division went in Guadalcanal at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's the insignia you wore? Hmm? That's the insignia?
Yeah, this is our insignia. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What rank were you at that time?
I was just a private. I back in those days, you didn't make PFC out of boot camp. Mm-hmm. I was just a private.
Okay.
And anyway, they decided we would take the island of Tulagi, and they had no problem taking the airstrip on Guadalcanal because there were very few troops there. They were mainly Korean workers working on the airstrip, so they didn't have any problems taking the airstrip itself. We had quite a battle over on Tulagi. Cause
now, how did you land? What kind of? Did you use the old Higgins boat?
The old Higgins boats were even over the sides. And we couldn't get within 100 yards of the beach because of the coral. Uh-huh. And so we had to wade in. Fortunately, it was not a defended beach. And we were anywhere from our knees to up to here, you know, in the water, depending on the coral and all that stuff. Because the boats couldn't go, it would have ripped the bottom. They were just wooden. Uh-huh. You know, the old Higgins boats were just wooden boats, no ramps. And that's the way we went in. And,
can I ask you a second? I think, wasn't your unit, they were one of the first to use the two-piece camouflage uniforms? Is that what you had? What kind of uniform did you wear?
No, not at that point. We still had the old green.
Oh, okay.
Everybody still had the old green. Uh-huh. No, they didn't come out to the camouflage until we went to New Georgia.
Oh, okay.
And then we had those, yeah.
All right.
And so instead of those camouflage things on the helmets, we had a hunk of burlap painted green on our helmets. Uh-huh. And
so you had the old herringbone type fatigues, but that like an OD type fatigue you wore?
Yeah, it was just almost a solid color, olive drab, you know, and just had the insignia and U.S. Marines on it. That was it. Dark green. That was it. Yeah, and no rank was on. I it's amazing. I see all these officers and non-coms with ranks out there in combat. Ours had no combat. No, of course, the Japs would pick them off first, you know.
Sure.
And another thing they would pick off first would be corpsmen. Uh-huh. See, of course, the Marines didn't have any medical things, so the Navy supplied corpsmen and doctors. And according to the Geneva Convention, they were supposed to wear a Red Cross band, no arms, one day. That was it. Mm-hmm. Off came these and on went the arms because the Japs were picking them off first so they couldn't treat anybody. And Tulagi was where the governor of the Solomon Islands, British all the Solomon Islands, lived prior to the war. And it was a beautiful little island about half mile wide, 3 miles long, and it had a polo ground and all this kind of stuff. And it had a lot of houses on it. And so we finally and a lot of caves. They had a lot of caves, and so we went down. We couldn't use our mortars after the first day because we thought we had them in such a small area that they could. But then we found out we had bypassed a lot of them. We were still in the caves, and then they came out at night. Then's when all hell broke loose, you know, and stuff. That's when we got a lot of our casualties were that night too. And so in about three or four days, we finally had it all secured, and we stayed there, and we went on patrols over to Florida Island, which was right there, but there's nothing over there. And in the meantime, Japs had tried to take back the airstrip in the Battle of Teneroo with 1,000 men. And the Marines just took them into a trap and annihilated them. And now if they'd have waited, then we went over towards the end of the month, and they knew that the Japs, all we had was just a little perimeter. I don't know if you can tell.
Oh, yes, he can focus on that.
On that, where this little square is, right down here. There's a little square down here. We're here. That's all we had of Guadalcanal. Just a perimeter defense around the airstrip. And the Japs could land any place. Mainly because, better back up a little bit here, on August 9th, 2 days after we'd gone in, there was a sea battle out near Savo Island. Mm-hmm. We lost 4 cruisers that night. And so our fleet took off. Went back to New Caledonia. Our transports went back. Half our supplies went back with them. Everything. So there we were. All by our lonesome.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I don't know. I was always an optimist. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. People try to tell us how bad it was, but I thought they were. Until later on, I found out that they were wrong. It was worse than they were telling us. and in fact, in one of the newest book that came out, they said we were known as the Marooned Division. Mm-hmm. Because we were just there.
And we interviewed a Marine that's called the Starvation Island. Did you have short rations? And?
Oh, yeah. We took rations for about 72 hours, about 3 days. But our colonel, he says, hey, the Japs were eating, so that's what we did on Telavi. We ate rice, their Japanese rice and all that mm-hmm. stuff, and we were down to about one meal a day. And so until they finally got things back into us, but it was quite a while. See, we had no air support. Mm-hmm. They could bomb us, they could shell us, and people ask, well, what made your battalion so much better than the others? And I said, well, it was training. And leadership, we had terrific leadership. And this Colonel Edson, while we were in Quantico, we'd go out on a Saturday morning, take a 22-mile hike, you know. And he would stop every once in a while and watch everybody go by. And then he'd double time up the top, take off. And when we came back, got in at the end of the barracks, he was there talking. He would make nice remarks to everybody, complimentary remarks to everybody as they came in. And that's the type of a fellow you're going to go with.
So you had a lot of respect for him as a leader?
Yeah, a lot of respect. Oh, Colonel Edson, he was...
Did you have that much personal contact with him?
No. And that was two things. And not only leadership, but the leadership they developed in us. Because a lot of guys who, after the war, went on, and myself, I retired as a full professor from a college. And I felt that's probably equivalent to a colonel in the Marine Corps or something anyway, And a lot of guys went into, developed leadership roles after. Well, in fact, we had four received the Congressional Medal of Honor. We had eight of our battalion members became generals, and I got a list in there of all the other, Navy Crosses, Silver Stars. 24 Navy ships are named after fellows from our one battalion, which is, I don't think there's any other battalion, one battalion. They keep telling me, it's probably the outstanding battalion the Marine Corps ever had. And when we go back for our reunions in Quantico, they treat us all. It just, you know, it's fantastic. And of course, we're smaller and smaller. Last time, I think we only had about 25 of us there, and we're losing 15, 20 guys every year. And somebody said, "Well, how many are alive?" We don't know. We're in existence 2 years, and in a 2 year period, 2,600 guys went through the battalion, you know, replacements and so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, let's go back.
I just have one question I want to ask you. Did you have any specialized equipment that the other Marines didn't have? I heard that the Raiders were issued a special type dagger or knife they carried.
Yeah, we had stilettos.
Uh-huh.
That's the only thing we had, just the stilettos, that's all.
But the rest of your equipment
everything was...
I also read that you had some British or Canadian guns with you, specialized guns, or you didn't?
No, not that. Mm-hmm. I was aware of them.
Yeah, okay. But you did carry the 03 basically through the entire Guadalcanal campaign.
Guadalcanal. And when the 7th Marines came on in October, I think they were the first ones to bring on the M1. Mm-hmm.
Did you like the M1 or did you prefer the 03?
I never had an M1.
Or, I mean, okay.
Well, the reason I never had an M1 was because I left the island with the 03s. And then when we went down to New Zealand for some liberty and then came back to New Caledonia. New Caledonia was kind of our base. Mm-hmm. And then we got in replacements. And then they decided to do away with the weapons company. So they sent two machine guns and a mortar to each weapon, to each rifle company. They already had two machine guns and mortars. So that gave each rifle company four machine guns and three mortars. And so I was a gunner at the time on this squad. And the first squad, we went down to A Company. When we got down to A Company, they needed a squad leader for their second squad, so I went over and took over the second squad, and my weapon then was a carbine. Mm-hmm. So they were just a couple months off out of the factory.
What did you think of the carbine?
It was nice, because we didn't have to fire. You couldn't see 100 yards a lot of times. You were young, and so it was for... You know, it was light, and I think they had about 20 rounds or so. So anyway, let's go back to Guadalcanal here when we went over. I say that we just had that perimeter defense around. Now, down the beach, they know that the Japs had been landing down a place called Tassamboko. Colonel Edson, he had been in China prior to the war, and he knew what the Japs were going to do before they knew what they were going to do, really. So he knew it was trouble if we didn't get down and do something with that where they were landing. So they sent us down to raid this village down there at Tassamboko. And when we got down there, the main body had already pushed off into the jungles. And they had four pieces of artillery there, which if we hadn't destroyed it, they would have used this on us on the Battle of Bloody Ridge. And so we destroyed them, pulled them out to sea, blew up their ammunition dump, destroyed what chow we couldn't push in our pockets while we destroyed. And they had everything. They had bicycles and everything there. And so then we came back, and there was a gap in the defense around Henderson Airfield on this Lunga Ridge. And Edson just knew that this is where they were going to attack. And it took a while for him to convince General Vandegrift for us to go out and put up our defense around there. And still then, we were spread out quite a bit too. So on September 12th and 13th, that's when they attacked us. And there were 700 of us, about 3,500 of the Japs. And what helped save us was the 11th Marines artillery. We had our forward observer right up there by Edson. I could hear them all night long. And they were dropping them just 100 yards ahead of us. When you hear these things coming in, you swear they're going to drop in on you. But they kept them scattered enough so that we could, not too many could hit us at once. But it was a two and three day. They bombed us and everything the night before, shelled us. And they knew right where we were. Mm-hmm. And after that morning, while we pulled off, and the 5th Marines took off, the Japs took off, and they left. I got pictures of what they'd left on. There's estimates of anywhere from 800 to 1400 that they left on Bloody Ridge. There was grass like this the night before, and the next day you could hardly see a blade of grass, but they just kept choom, bonsai, 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 you know. And they wouldn't. Yeah, another thing, when I came back from overseas, people asked me, what's the difference between the American servicemen and the Japanese? And I said, well, and I think Germans the same way. We were taught to think for ourselves. But they were just, they just follow orders, bandai, you know. If they would have probed, they would have found that we didn't have anything to our left. They could have circled around and surrounded, but they just had head on. I think on D-Day, I think you probably look back, you've probably seen a lot of those things, where there were cases where American junior officers, NCOs, made decisions, uh-huh. important decisions. But yet, there was a German general in tanks. He knew what he had to do, but he couldn't do it because he didn't get orders from above. Uh-huh. Rommel was off at a birthday party to his wife, and Hitler was asleep, and nobody dared wake him up. And the guy couldn't get any orders to do it. So as a result, he couldn't do what he knew he had to do. But yet there were, as you've probably heard, many, many cases of junior officers and NCOs making decisions on the spot. And we could make decisions on the spot. And in fact, that last morning on the ridge, we were behind one little ridge, and there was a Jap machine gun had come up, and somebody up ahead of us in the headquarters going, "Hey, can you get 150 yards on that pea shooter?" "Yeah, okay." So he held up a gun. We sighted in on that. He says, "Well, go 10 mils right, 10 mils." That was it. So we, and then there was a jungle down in here off this ridge. And they were in there, and they had the range of the ridge with their mortars, knee mortars, and machine guns. And they were picking us off. In fact, I don't know, I was up there, and all of a sudden I looked up, and here comes one right at me. Just happened to lip beside me and rolled down the hill, never went off. But anyway, we pattern fired our mortars down in that area. You know, we'd get one, and we'd go 10 mils right. 10 mils right, up 25 yards, 10 mils left, 10 mils left, do one and move over. And we did that. We must have thrown in over 100 rounds in there. We silenced the whole crew. So that's where our little 60 millimeter mortars, and nobody teased us about our pea shooters anymore, you know. So we came off, and we had about, I don't know, close to 50% casualties that night. Or those two nights.
Did you have any hand-to-hand fighting yourself? Or
anyone?
Hand-to-hand fighting yourself?
Myself, no. I did not. Mm-hmm. I was just where I was. I was where I was supposed to be, when mm-hmm. I was supposed to be there, doing what I was supposed to do. I guess it just happened to be that I was in the mortars, and that's what we were called on to do what we did there. So when we came off, then we went back into Coconut Grove. And in the meantime, Edson, he had made full colonel. See, and a battalion has a lieutenant colonel. So he, Vandegrift relieved the commander of the 5th Regiment and made Edson the commander of the 5th Regiment. And so up the other way, up at the Matanikau, on the other side, up at the Matanikau, the Japs had come in that way too. And that's where the 5th Regiment was. And so we were back Well, we'd gone up a couple of times to try to circle around them and everything, but we were unsuccessful because they were just, well, what do we have? 60 millimeter mortars, that's all we have. So we came back, and they said, "All right, now you're going to be the reserves of the reserves. In fact, the only time they'll call on you if the island is in danger of being retaken." So one morning, you see an A and C company back in their gear. "Where are they going?" "Well, they're going up to guard Edson CP. "Oh, okay." next morning, get your gear ready. Where are we going? Well, they had to use A&C company last night, so we're going up to Garvin, CP. And so fortunately, that's all we did do. But that night, there was a lot of skirmishing going on. And some Japs had come on our side of the Matanikau River, and they were trying to get back before the tide came in so they could wade through. And they ran into our A Company mortars who were digging in. And there was skirmishing, and Edson thought they were trying to come this way, but they were trying, and he was yelling at them, screaming, "You got a hold, you got a hold." And we went up the next day, and we pulled 8 of our fellows and about 60 Japanese, all hand-to-hand, not a shot fired. It was, and this was 4 days before we had to leave the island. And these poor guys got it that one night, you know. And so anyway, then when the Army came in, they brought in 3,000 Army from New Caledonia. They'd been sitting down there, and I don't know, for some reason the Navy wanted this an all-Navy Marine show. I don't know why. Uh-huh. But they finally brought up this division of Army from New Caledonia, and that's what we left on. And on those transports. In fact, we left a little early because we had this character called Pistol Pete. He was a piece of artillery up in the hills, and he would shell us. When they would bomb, he would drop some shells, and you got to think, hey, there's a different sound between a bomb and a shell. No, and then we figured out that he was shelling the same time they were dropping bombs on us. Well, he started to shoot the ships. A couple of rounds went through the rigging on the ship, and the old captain of the ship, "Hoist anchor and get out of here." In fact, he left some of his Higgins boats there. And so we went back. And to show you the difference between our, you know, the American servicemen and theirs, when we got aboard ship, there were some prisoners aboard here. There had been Japanese sailors who had been picked up. I don't know where this ship picked them up or somebody else picked them up and moved them to this ship to take them back. And they had sheets, blankets, pillowcases. We had bare mattresses to sleep on. But that's how they treated us. But the way the Japs treated guys in the water, they would run them over with their destroyers and machine gun, you know, survivors in them, and that again was a little difference, and that kind of irritated us, because some of them were these APDs that got sunk, who were very, very good friends of ours, you know. Uh-huh. And in fact, when we went from Tulagi to Guadalcanal, we were on this Calhoun, and it was late afternoon, and they said, they were debating whether to take us ashore or leave us and take us ashore the next morning. Well, let's take them ashore. We hadn't even hit the beach yet, and the ship was gone. They had a bombing, and then the ship went down in 3 minutes, you know, so there was another close call, you know, just, and by the time we left there, all of those APDs had been sunk, you know, and as you look on this chart, the Navy lost a lot more men mm-hmm. on Guadalcanal than the Marines did because of all the sea battles that were. I don't know if you ever heard uh-huh. of Iron Bottom Sound. You yes. know? All the ships are down there. I've got a big book I have here has pictures of all mm-hmm. these ships that are down at the bottom of that Iron Bottom Sound. And so then we went back to New Caledonia. And a ship was going down in a dry dock, going down to Wellington, New Zealand. And it said, okay, as long as it stays, you can stay. Well, we were aboard ship on Thanksgiving going down. And they had supposedly a nice Thanksgiving turkey dinner, but they ran out, and I got cold cuts. But it was still better than what I'd been getting on Guadalcanal. And so then we got down there right after Thanksgiving, and we spent Christmas and New Year's, and then it was one of the finest Christmases I ever spent. And all we had to do was come back and check in at 8:00 in the morning. That's all we had to do. A lot of guys got hotel, right? Hey, I got a bunk. I'm not going to pay a bunk. So I'd come back to the ship, and the day before Thanksgiving, I said, well, maybe I'll go to the Y and get a bunk, you know, and in their gymnasium, they'd put up double-deckers, and so I got a bunk for 3 nights, and breakfast, and it cost me $2.06, 40 cents a night, breakfast. And as I was coming out, some old elderly lady stopped me and said, "You got a place to eat Christmas dinner tomorrow?" I says, "No." She says, "Well, come up to my place." And she told me where she lived. "If you got any friends looking for places," so I asked, and I couldn't find anybody, so I called her. "Well, come on up. I live at 12 Apuka Street, A-P-U-K-A. I still remember that. Way up in the Brooklyn section of Wellington, New Zealand. And I climbed, and the streetcars weren't running after Christmas Day, so I walked up there. And she had a couple more American sailors, a couple New Zealand sailors, and her nephew, her grandson, who was later in the New Zealand Air Force. And a nice, that was my first experience with plum pudding. And I ate it, and all of a sudden, something hit, oh, wow, a piece of coin or something. And then somebody else said, "Oh, I got a threepence, I got a sixpence." That's what they did, they put money in the thing. So I ended up with a threepence. And so then after the ship got out of dry dock, well, then we went back to New Caledonia, got in our replacements, and then back up to Guadalcanal, to a little more training, then went up to New Georgia. And now the airstrip Munda was on New Georgia. Well, in the meantime, I got a letter from my brother, and I didn't know he was in the service at the time until I got this letter from him and said he was in the Army Engineers, 181st Engineers. So I got a letter from him and said they speak French on the island where he was. I said, "Well, he's either got to be here in New Caledonia or up in the Hebrides." And somebody said, "I think I remember seeing that sign." So I got to go into Noumea and the town there, and I got right on over the truck cab. I told the driver, "And if I pound on the cab, stop, will you, and let me off." Okay. So we're going down. There I was, 181st Engineers. So I pounded, he let me off, and I started walking up the road. Three trucks were coming down. Pretty soon one slammed on his brakes, and there my brother was driving one of them. So we were together there for a while until I shoved off. He came out one time, and we were gone. And I figured he must have been on Monday, too, because Engineers are Army. But after the war, we got together, and yes, he had been on Monday. Now, we were on the northern side of New Georgia, and a guy in Barocco knocking out their supply bases up there. And so that's where we, and they had 10,000 Japs on Kolomangara, which we could see. They could see us right across the bay. It's where John Kennedy was with his PT boat, mm-hmm. right in that area. And we had landed down at Rice Anchorage at night on the 4th of July, and we'd come 2 days through the jungles, 3 days through a swamp to come in behind the Japs. We just never figured anybody come that way. That's what our outfit was known. Show them something that can't be done, and we do it. And so then we took the Inagai, the outpost there. We never really did take Barocco, but oh, they were dug in and everything. And in the meantime, the engineers were building a road from Munda over. And one day we sent a patrol down, some guy got killed. The next day the army came walking in and they were gone. We knew they were doing something. They were doing a lot of pounding and everything, and they were evacuating and going over to Kolomangara. And we used to... And Warship Machine Charlie, he was on Guadalcanal too. He's one of these little old things that come over and drop a bomb just to harass you, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, what we would do, we would go down where we had landed. We would stand up in the Higgins boat and get supplies and then stay down, come back. So they figured we were still there. And they'd come over and bomb down there, nobody there, you know, so we outsmarted. But if they had known that all we had was about two battalions, they had 10,000 of them over there. They could have come over and wiped us out. And there were so many times that it was like on Guadalcanal, if the Japs had waited on the Teneru and Matanikau and the ridge and attacked all at once, there's no way we could have defended it. But it was just, and we found out later that their army and navy didn't get along too well. And so it was just two stupid things on their part that we survived. In fact, it was so bad there on Guadalcanal that Vandegrift was told to surrender. He never told us so. So we never knew.
Now, by New Georgia, you had the camouflage uniforms then?
No, New Georgia, we had the camouflage, but it didn't do any good. By the time we got through the swamps, they were all mud.
I had read that some of the units were given a flannel belly pack or strip like? Did you ever get a band, they called it? Did you ever get one of those?
No.
Okay, I was just curious. I'd read once where some of the units received these.
Now, one extra, we had an anti-tank gun when we went in there. Some of the guys carried an anti-tank gun. And that was the biggest weapon we had outside of our 60-millimeter mortars. So we just, you know, there's no way we could have got 81s through those jungles and swamps.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, I noticed you said you picked up jungle rat. Did you ever pick up any fevers or anything like that while you were?
Well, a lot of guys got malaria on Guadalcanal. I never got malaria. Huh. My brother was out there 3 years. He never got malaria. I don't know why.
What about dengue fever?
Not dengue fever. I had what they called cat fever. I don't know. I did that, got that a couple of times.
Was that the same as what they call cat scratch fever, or is that something different?
I don't know. A catarrh or something like that. And, of course, I had a jungle rot, and on Georgia, I had yellow jaundice, too. Mm-hmm. Not hepatitis, but yellow jaundice, which was dietary deficiencies. So, you know, your eyeballs turn yellow.
Were you hospitalized?
No.
No,
because we were leaving the island of Bedeck, New Caledonia, and there was a list coming out to come back to the States. And no way was I going to be in sick bay when that list came out. Mm-hmm. So I found out what they did for it. All they did was feed them ice cream and candy and sweet stuff. And so I got as much, and forced myself to eat. And by the time I got back to the States, it was
now, you mentioned here a story about someone, Jinx Powers, episode on New Caledonia.
Yeah, up on New Caledonia, New Georgia, yeah. And he got wounded before we took Anagai. He got wounded, and he could walk. So they sent him back. Now go back and, you know, get help, get yourself treated, and tell him we need help out here. You know, Stu Polonis was one of them. And he said, okay, well, they didn't hear from Jinx. And Jinx went the wrong way. Got into where the Japs were. So he said, well, they climbed trees. So he climbed a tree, got up on the top of a tree. And I guess he spent the night there. And then some of these guys, our guys, went out looking for Jinx. And he heard them coming. But he says, now if I yell at them, they're probably going to shoot me. So he started to sing Mamie Riley, which was a song that our guys used to sing. And there's Jinx. Let's go get him. it was something on Tulagi when I told you there was used to be a Reveille Joe, a Japanese destroyer, used to come up and down and shell a few one-way over the Guadalcanal and a few our way. Well, it would usually be about 5-6 o'clock in the morning. Well, the general on the island, he would come down and go into a cave right near where we had our mortars set up to protect the beach. Well, this one fellow of ours, Andy Dobie, he came off duty and he went in this cave and he set up a bunch of tin cans and wires and everything else. You know, if somebody came in, he'd stumble and wake him up. Well, then come down this general entourage, you know, and stumbled right into that. Oh, jeez. They were mad. They read him up and down and everything and sent him over to Colonel Edson. And I'm sure Colonel Edson didn't get along with his general anyway. And I'm sure it was all Edson could do was to keep from laughing right in the general's face. And then he congratulated Andy on his ingenuity. And another thing there on Tulagi, we don't have chaplains either. Navy supplies chaplains. The Navy chaplain used to come around. He says, you know, I like to start rumors. He said, by the time they get back to me, they're really good, you know. And then another time he came around, he says, now, after the war, he came from Chicago. He says, after the war, I'm going to get about 50 raiders and paratroopers, and I'm going to go in and clean out the underworld of Chicago. So anyway, then we finally left New Georgia and back to New Caledonia, and when I came back to the States, and I was stationed down at Camp Elliott, and I said I'd been in college, and I got over there. I said, hey, that college bit wasn't so bad after all, you know. And I'd heard that they had this V-12 program. I don't know if you knew anything about that or not. It was a Navy and where they would send high school kids, graduates, to college for 8 semesters, then send them to midshipman school. And they had a section for the Marine Corps, too. And the Marines would go for 4 semesters, then go to Quantico for OCS. So when they come back, they gave us 2 choices. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to get into that, V-12. He says, well, why don't you wait till you come back? He says, give me the other 2, and this will give you 3 choices. And he says, so I had guard duty as one, so I got guard duty on Camp Elliott in the main gate, and then applied to my commanding officer for the V-12 program. And I got it. And so in July of 44, I was sent to Denison University, which was not too far from my home in Ohio. And but after 1 semester, they did away with the Marine unit there and shipped us up to Oberlin College in Ohio. And so in my 4th semester, the war ended. So they said, oh, you got to go 8 semesters now before you go to Quantico. So I was going to go back to general duty, and the commanding officer said, well, why don't you take another semester? So I took another semester. My enlistment was up in January, so I extended until March, and I got out. And then I went back to Oberlin as a civilian, and eventually finished up. And I don't know if you are aware of what kind of school Oberlin College is or not. You know, it's one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country. They wouldn't have even looked at me, because I didn't even have any high school, college preparatory courses in high school. I took industrial arts in high school. And but I did well enough while I was there that they let me come back. And the coaches see what they wanted, because I played football, basketball, and baseball, too. So, and but eventually, you know, normally it takes about 120, 125 hours to get a bachelor's degree. Well, I had 165 hours by the time I got mine, with making up all the deficiencies and everything. And so then I went right out of college. I was 26 by the time. I got married a month after we graduated. Right into a college job, teaching and coaching job. What was then Patterson State, which is now William Patterson College. And I taught there a couple of years. Well, then the Korean Command. And I was in the reserve, so they called me back in. So I spent a year down in Portsmouth, Virginia in special service. When I went back in, they gave me the same MOS that I had when I was in before, you know, 60 millimeter mortar. And some sergeant, he says, ah, this isn't right. You've got a degree, you've got teaching. So he sent me over to an officer, and they gave me a special service secondary, and that's what I got into, special services.
Now, what rank were you at that point?
I was corporal. See, all the time I was in the V-12, all ranks were frozen. Everybody reverted back to privates, even though on your record you were still. See, I made PFC after Guadalcanal, and in the record book I was still a PFC, but all the time I was in there, everybody was like a private. So then when I went to get discharged, well, if you'd been in rank enough time, they'd get promoted. So that's I got promoted to corporal when I got discharged. So when he called me back in, and but I couldn't get commissioned because I was too old. The cutoff date was 26, and I was 27. But then I made sergeant, and that was all right. I mean, I had a pretty good deal. I was player coach of the basketball team. Did the Post newspaper and a few things like this. And then after a year, 13 months, and I went back to my Patterson job and then up to Bates College for 3 years, and then out to Doan College in Crete, Nebraska for 5 years, and then YMCA work in Pennsylvania for 2 years, and then this job up here at Adirondack. The school was 1 year old when I came up here, and I set up all the phys ed, intramurals, athletics and stuff.
Now, did you ever, I know you got your education while you're in, but did you ever make use of the GI Bill?
Oh, yes. I went 8 summers. And I got my master's degree, and I got a 30-hour certificate beyond my master's degree.
Okay.
They call an education, a specialist in education. I got all those at NYU.
Mm-hmm. Did you join any veterans organizations?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I still belong. I got a life membership in the Legion. Got life membership in the Marine Corps League, and I held officers. Here's one of these. Yeah, there's a past commandant of the detachment. I was a commandant there for a couple of years. Past president of our Edson's Association.
So you stayed in contact with
Oh, yeah.
People that served with you.
I'm not active now because I've had a couple of, blood clots in my lungs, you know, and so I said, well, I can't go to meetings without piping off, you know, and expressing myself. So, so I just sit back now. Well, I say, 82 years old, I guess it's time to relax a little bit. And this button, people ask me about that. I don't know. See what it is? Heisman.
Oh,
Heisman Club. Johnny Heisman, his first coaching job was at Oberlin College. Uh-huh. He was Oberlin's first football coach. And so now they have a club, and they're the club that determines who goes into their athletic hall of fame. And so I'm a member of that, and I'm a member of the Heisman Club.
Okay. How do you think your time in the service changed or had an effect on your life?
Oh, I go back when I was home once, one weekend, I had a picture taken, you know. Uh-huh. And when I came back from overseas, it was very solemn, you know. When I came back from overseas, I had another picture taken. I had a nice smile and everything. And I told my mother, get rid of that. And she says, no, that's the way you were then. This is the way you are now. So it developed leadership. Uh-huh. My leadership much, much better, you know, than others. Became a leader, I think.
Okay, could you tell us, if you hold this up like this, Wayne can focus on it, and yeah. Tell us a little bit about where and when that was taken? And
all right, this was my squad, my 60-millimeter mortar squad on Guadalcanal, taken in September 1942. Now, you go across the top, I think over here, this was John Burke. In the middle was Nadeau. And Pat Reith was the one over here. Eddie Rakowski is down here, and I'm over here, the gunner, or the assistant gunner. He was a gunner, and I was assisting him. This is what was left of a nine-man squad. And right now, Marlon Nadeau and I are the only two left. Uh-huh. The rest of
where and when was that taken?
This was taken on Guadalcanal in September of 1942. Okay. See the coconut grove in the background?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so. And I don't know what a squad leader was. He must have been in sick bay, I guess. A lot of guys in sick bay with malaria or diarrhea and stuff like that. So he must have. The first squad leader I had got hit the first day on Tulagi. And our gunner got hit. And so Nowakowski moved up to gunner, and I moved up to assistant gunner. Another corporal took over the squad. And I don't know what happened to him. And I don't know what happened to him after the war either. Uh-huh. And in fact, and on when we'd come off Guadalcanal, we were in New Caledonia sitting around talking what we were going to do after the war. Well, there was these two corporals, the guy who was our squad leader and another corporal. And so we were talking, and I said, well, I'm going to go back to college and play ball. And he said, kids will run circles around you. Well, they didn't. And so I wrote to this one corporal that I found his address. He was down in Florida. And I told him, I started out, you were wrong. And then I told him what I had done in college. Uh-huh. Played football all Ohio 4 years, captain of the basketball team, led the baseball team, and hitting all this kind of stuff, and gotten involved. And he no sooner got that, and he called me on the phone. He says, that made my day, he said. And as I say, we still get together every year down in Quantico. We used to go down in February. But after 2 years of snowstorms in Quantico, because the reason they got together in February, because that was when we actually started to form. Uh-huh. Well, then they went to April when they went overseas. So it's much better going down in April now.
I imagine.
And we, as I say, last time I think there were about 25 of us there. We lose 15, 20 guys every year. Uh-huh. However, we have over 100 at our big dinner on Saturday night because we have sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters, And recently, the last 5 years or so, we've been getting nieces and nephews and younger brothers and sisters of fellows who got killed. Ah. They want to come and find out. Mm-hmm. You know, and in fact, there's a fellow, his brother was 6 months older than I am, was, and he went in the same, from Indiana, he went in the same Marine Corps same day I did, got to boot camp the same time. He was in platoon 69, I was in platoon 66. We went up to Quantico together, rifle fire to rifle range, into the Raiders together. He went in B Company, I went in E Company. He got killed first day of college, first day. And so his younger brother has been coming the last few years, and not just last year, but the year before, he got to talk to a fella who was right beside his brother when he got killed. Mm-hmm. So he's been getting a lot of closure. Uh-huh. And that's the type of... So we've been getting people like that coming. And we always have some kind of a general come and talk. And, uh-huh. In fact, a lot of things that we instigated, the Marine Corps still uses. The team, fire teams. We were the first ones to use the fire teams. You know, in a squad, there used to be 2 BARs to a squad. Well, they made 3 fire teams in each squad, and each fire team had a BAR, so that gave us a lot more firepower. And so we were one of the, and we of course we were the leaders of all these rubber boat, you know, amphibious landings and all that kind of stuff. And but it was just, I don't know. They say, you know, of course, once a Marine, always a Marine. But, and the Raiders, we were just something different, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, anything else you want to
add? No, I guess that's it. Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you. Could we kind of